Why have most of your films been about institutions?
Why have they been about institutions? Well, because after I made Titicut Follies, which is a film about a prison for the criminally insane, or in the course of making that, I realized what you could do for a prison for the criminally insane you could do for other places, namely make a film about them. And it seemed to me that this was relatively unexplored territory in film terms, because not all, but many documentary films up to that point would pick one charming person, a prize fighter, a movie producer, a movie star, or somebody with an eccentric personality, and make them the focus of the film. And I thought it'd be more interesting to try and do a series of films where the place was the star, and where the film would be an impressionistic and perhaps novelistic account of what the place was like, with and not following any one individual.
Do you have a point of view about the place when you go in and start shooting?
Yeah, I always have a point of view, but invariably that point of view changes as a consequence of learning something, because most of the time my point of view is based on very little knowledge or experience, or certainly frequently is the case. The most extreme example I can give you to illustrate that is my attitude, say, about the police before I made Law and Order, because the film was shot in the fall of 1968, in Kansas City, and it was shot right after the Democratic Convention and the police riots on the streets of Chicago. So that it was the trendy view at that time, not only because of what happened in Chicago but elsewhere, that the police were all pigs. Well, you ride around in the police cars for approximately 15 seconds and you realize that the piggery is in no way restricted to the police, because you see what people do to each other that make it necessary to have police in the first place, which is not any... is not to excuse police brutality when it does exist, but to, what it is to do is not isolate it from other forms of human brutality, which make it necessary to have police to respond to and protect other people from.
Well, it's a less simplistic way of looking at things, that there are good guys and bad guys on both sides of the fence. Do you find that a lot when you go into a place, that there aren't obvious good guys and bad guys?
Yeah,
and
very
that,
often.
That the good and bad is a lot more ambiguous?
Yeah, well, I mean, ambiguity and ambivalence rules the day, because, you know, I mean, just like in our own experience or the way we act ourselves.
I sometimes wonder why people, or why the people at the top of an institution would let you film them, because sometimes the people really don't end up looking very good. And... you never know how you're going to come off if there's someone with a camera and a microphone recording everything that you do.
Well, as someone, as the fellow once said, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. I've now made 18 films in this style, and I've only in three of those situations have the people given me permission not like the film. And in each of those situations, they've only turned against the film not when they first saw it, because when they first saw it, they liked it, but only when they didn't like the way they or some of the people in the film were characterized in the reviews.
Which were those three?
Primate, High School, and Titicut Follies.
And those are the most controversial ones that you did, too.
Well, I mean, they're controversial because, in part at least, because the people that were in them originally liked them and then subsequently were put on the defensive by what was written about the films, not by their initial response.
We'll get back to those films in a little while. What do you say to people who you want to convince to let you shoot them at work? Who do you talk to? Do you talk to the people at the top of the organization?
Yeah, I always try to talk to the person in charge of the organization on the assumption that he's the one, or he or she is the one that has the authority to give me permission. What I try to do is to find somebody whom I know, or a friend of a friend, who will introduce me so that I'm not somebody coming in off the street and somebody can say, well, you ought to talk to Wiseman. In my view, he makes interesting movies, and maybe you want to consider having him make a movie here. I mean, it's essentially asking for a good housekeeping seal of approval. But my presentation, I think, is very direct. I say I've been doing a series of films. I offer to show the previous films that I've made. I say I don't know what my point of view is about the material, because I don't really I essentially don't really have one, except some prejudices, perhaps, which I'm perfectly willing to state. That my experience has always been that my attitude changes as a consequence of making the film, that if they give me permission, I want access to everything that's going on, with the understanding that on any given sequence or event, nobody has to agree to be photographed, and I will always respect that, as long as they say they don't want to be photographed either before or just after the sequence, even if the sequence has been shot. If they tell me immediately afterwards that they don't want to use, I won't use it. On the other hand, I make it absolutely clear that I have total editorial control over the material and that I don't give anybody the right to review the material when I finish the editing to then make the decision whether a sequence is permissible or whether the whole film is okay.
Do the people from the place have an agenda usually that they want to tell you about?
No, I make it clear that I want the freedom to sort of wander around and decide what to shoot. I think if the people have an agenda, it's generally speaking that they feel pleased with the work that they're doing, or they want a wider audience to be aware of some of the difficulties that they have and some of the problems that they have. Generally speaking, I guess people feel they have nothing to hide. And I suppose to some extent vanity enters into it, although it's very hard to know what sort of percentage to assign to the various elements that are involved in granting permission.
You will allow people to tell you before or after something takes place that they don't want to be shot doing it. But the people who are actually making the decision about whether the movie gets made are the people at the top of the organizational chart, so to speak, in any place where
right.
you're filming. And I wonder if you've ever experienced a situation where some of the workers who weren't in on the decision felt burned by the decision to have you and a camera person there filming them.
Are they usually
consulted?
Well, it depends at what point in the process you're referring to. If you're referring to the initial decision and the period of the shooting, as far as I know, nobody's ever felt burnt. In if you're referring to the follow-up reaction, and I'll make the distinction that I made before between when people initially see the film and when the film is reviewed, then it's never happened when they've initially seen the film that they've turned against it. It has happened in the three instances that I've mentioned, after the reviews have appeared, that they've turned against the film, even though they initially liked it.
But no one ever objects to you being there, weren't in on the decision
I can't say no one, but once or twice at the most, maybe three times in the course of a shooting will somebody say, I don't want my picture taken, or stay away. But in terms of the number of people one's dealing with, which is sometimes hundreds or sometimes thousands in the sense of the possibilities, it's so rare as to be insignificant that somebody will object.
My guest is documentary filmmaker Fred Wiseman. I'm sure when you start filming that you want people to feel comfortable around the recording equipment, the microphones and the camera. What do you do to make yourself as inconspicuous as possible so that you don't interfere with their behavior or with the work that they have to do?
Well, the worst thing you can do is say, hey, don't pay attention to me, don't look in the camera, oh, that's just a microphone. I mean, that's terrible. I mean, because that just calls attention to it. On the other hand, I mean, the microphone is, generally speaking, as close as the microphone is to me in the studio, although not in that position. It's usually just above the head of the person or persons that are talking, or just below the frame line, so that the mic either comes from above or comes up from below. And the camera is usually never more than 6, 7, 8 feet away, so that it's all done in the open. What I try to do is demystify the process to the extent that I can in advance. For example, when I made the movie at the Welfare Center, I had a staff meeting. I didn't have a staff meeting, but I attended a staff meeting. And I explained, I went through essentially the same kind of procedure that I did with the director of the welfare agency in New York, Welfare Administration. But I had the camera and the tape recorder there, and I explained to people how it was used, and I let people come up and look through the eyepiece of the camera, and I put the earphones on anybody that wanted to see how the tape recorder worked and how the delay system in the tape recorder worked, so that they became aware of the fact that when I was recording sound, I was really listening on the earphones to sound that was already recorded. I was listening off the tape rather than through the mic. And so to the extent that it's possible, I introduce the film that way. Also, if there's a newspaper in the organization or a daily bulletin, I'll put in a notice there. I'll ask the administration to put in a notice saying there's going to be a film crew here for the next 4 or 5 weeks representing public television, essentially reciting the terms of the arrangement so that nobody is surprised. Now, obviously, that never reaches everybody who's a possible participant in the film because, again, in the example of the welfare center, I mean, while the staff might know, people are popping through the door who were only in the welfare center for 3 or 4 hours that day and never heard of it. Now, with them, with people in that situation, I get tape-recorded consents, which means that sometimes before, but usually after the sequence is shot, I will walk up to them, say that I've got the tape recorder running, hold a mic in a position between us, and then explain what I'm doing, essentially, again, a version of what I'd said previously in this interview, and ask them if they have any objection to having their pictures taken or their voice recorded. And I say, even if the sequence is shot, I'll say, even though the sequence is shot, if you don't want me to use it, I won't. And as I say, 99.9% of the time, they'll say okay. If they say okay, I ask them for their name and address, which in turn gives me a contemporaneous record of their consent. Now, I don't believe in a public institution that I have to do that. I do that as a matter I feel that I have to do it as a matter of my personal morality in the situation. I don't feel I have to do it legally, which gets us into the whole area of the application of the First Amendment to documentary filmmaking of this sort versus the right of privacy, which I don't know whether you want to get into that now. But fundamentally, what I rely on and what any filmmaker relies on who makes films dealing with public institutions and a situation where, by definition of public institutions, where tax money is spent to support it, relies on the First Amendment for protection on the theory that what goes on is news, even though it doesn't appear till maybe a year later, but it's news in the same way that what appears in the newspaper every morning is news. It's just presented in a different form.
How do you know if your presence is actually changing people's behavior or not? Because you're presenting the movies as the reality of what happens in this place, but the reality might be somewhat altered by your presence there. People might be trying to impress the camera or trying to, you know, just play up certain of their own characteristics, either for vanity or to just look the way they think they're supposed to be looking because there's a movie being made. How can you tell if they're behaving differently because you're there?
Well, I mean, there's no way, obviously, with the precision of modern science to know the answer to that question. But what you rely on is your judgment and your experience to the extent that you have any of either. And the situation is really no different than the situation that anybody finds themselves in who has to deal with a lot of people all the time. You, as an interviewer, have to make a judgment when you are being conned, as does a school teacher, an insurance salesman, a doctor, a lawyer, anybody that an administrator dealing with a lot of people, whether in a corporation or in a public administration or whatever. Because both to preserve your own sanity and for the proper functioning of the place, you have to have a fairly sensitive bullshit meter. I mean, that's the scientific term that I would use that's applied in the situation. So that if you think somebody's putting it on for the camera, you stop shooting. If you don't realize it till you get back in the editing room, you don't use the sequence. But just as in any other profession, or just like any other person that deals with a lot of people all the time, you can be wrong. But it's an issue you become extremely sensitive to. That's one aspect of it. The other aspect of it is that most of the time you're making one of these movies, you're not shooting. You're hanging around. For example, I'll take a different film. I made a film about a hospital in New York City. Well, I was probably at the hospital 15 or 16 hours a day for a month. Most of it would get shot in the course of the day with maybe 2 hours of film. That's quite a lot of film to shoot. So the other, say, 14 hours, you're hanging around. You may not even you might not even be carrying the equipment. It might be under a chair. That hanging around period is extremely important for figuring out what to shoot, what's going on, and making a judgment about what constitutes normal behavior, because you're seeing the same people perform similar tasks when you're not shooting. So that gives you some kind of a standard against which to judge the actual, or what actually goes on when you are shooting. But it's impressionistic and not infallible.
My guest is documentary filmmaker Fred Wiseman. Your first documentary film was Titicut Follies, which was shot at the Bridgewater State Hospital for the Criminally Insane. And it's really appalling conditions that you see when you see the movie. Describe a couple of the images that you saw that you recorded on film that really stay in your mind.
Well, there's one sequence of a man who was imprisoned in Bridgewater in 1927, I believe, because he painted a horse to look like a zebra as a gimmick to sell ice cream on Cape Cod. And he was picked up for vagrancy. And at that time, there were legal aid societies the organizations that offered legal services to the poor were not as organized or as didn't really exist in the form they do now. And he was never tried, I believe. And he died in Bridgewater in 1973. And he sings a song in front of a TV set, and it's quite touching, really, and sad. And so you get, unless I'm reading into it, you get a sense of the sadness of a man who's been institutionalized for, at that point, close to 40 years, because the film was made in 1966. Or there's another sequence where a man who won't eat is force-fed, it turns out the reason he probably hadn't eaten is that he had a heart attack, and nobody noticed, nobody knew that, and he died a day or two later. He didn't die of the forced feeding, but the forced feeding is extremely grotesque, because one of the things that he's being force-fed by a doctor who barely speaks English, and the doctor has a cigarette in his mouth, and the whole tension in the scene is whether the ash of the cigarette is going to drop into the funnel through which the broth is being poured down the man's nostrils. And there's another scene of a man who's been kept naked in his cell for 17 years doing a little dance in the cell and being taunted and subsequently hit by one of the guards.
You've said before that when you do a documentary, you try to go to a place where you think people are doing what they do very well or have a reputation for doing it very well. Was that the case at the hospital here?
Yeah, Bridgewater. Well, Bridgewater, it was euphemistically called a hospital, it's technically in the Massachusetts prison system and is in fact a prison for the criminally insane, and it's a distinction that is important, particularly in relation to the First Amendment issues. But at the time, as bad as Bridgewater was, it was probably one of the best places of its kind. I mean, if you, when 1966 went to a prison for the criminally insane in Mississippi, Bridgewater might have looked like a Hilton Hotel.
Now, this film is not available for distribution now. You have to, I think, be in the profession and be screening it to a professional group.
Well,
is that right?
It's not available to be shown on television or theatrically. By order of the Massachusetts Supreme Court, it can be seen by doctors, lawyers, judges, legislators, people interested in custodial care, and students in these and related fields, but not the merely curious general public, on condition that I give the court and the Attorney General's office in Massachusetts a week's notice of any screening and then file an affidavit after the screening that everybody that saw the movie is within the class of people allowed to see the movie. What that effectively means is, when you think of a student in these or related fields, it means that, you know, anybody, certainly high school or above, who's studying government can see the movie, or interested in film, or interested in social science, or interested in prisons, or interested in the police. But what it effectively does is bar it from being seen on television or theatrically.
And that's because the institution sued for invasion of privacy?
Yes, the suit was brought by the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And the plaintiffs were the Commissioner of Correction and the Superintendent of the Prison and the Attorney General.
You were talking before about the conflict between First Amendment rights and and the right of privacy. How do you see those rights coming into play in the controversy over the movie that we're talking about, Tiruchirappalli's?
Well, I mean, here's a prison for the criminally insane that's totally supported by public money. I don't know whether it had any federal money at that point or not, but certainly most of the money came from the state of Massachusetts. So that any citizen of the state of Massachusetts who paid taxes was supporting that place. The argument is that what goes on in a public institution is news. If a print journalist went in there, he could write a story about it. At the time the movie was made, as a way of educating the public, the superintendent of Bridgewater was allowing, I think there were something like 9 or 10,000 visitors a year, which is still more people than have seen the film in Massachusetts. 9 or 10,000 visitors a year were being taken through all the wards of the institution. In fact, I have on film a tour of some high school students from a local high school being taken through the Bridgewater by their coach. I think it was a football coach, to show them the folly of a life of crime. Now, it's not a sequence I used in the film, but it's a sequence I had in the outs. The judge wouldn't let it be introduced in the trial. We tried to introduce it at trial on this very point, that it was an open institution, in much the way that Charenton was an open institution at the time of the French Revolution. The state asserted that the film invaded the privacy of the inmates. Now, in talking about the right of privacy, you have to separate out one's personal view of what constitutes a right of privacy from the legal right of privacy. A legal right of privacy arises from one of two ways, either by statute or by common law tradition. At the time the film was made in Massachusetts, there was no right of privacy. There was neither a statutory nor a common law right of privacy, so it didn't exist. Our argument was that even if it did exist, the public's right to know about these conditions in a place where the medical and the psychiatric facilities, the staffing were terrible, and men were kept naked in their cells and guards occasionally brutalized the prisoners, was the overriding value. The state asserted that I had contracted away my First Amendment rights, even though there was no evidence to that. It was my word against the superintendent's word. I mean, there was no written evidence to support that view.
Your second movie was also very controversial. Your movie, High School, was shot at Northeast High in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
And you were living, I think, in Boston at the time. Why did you choose to do a movie about a high school in Philadelphia? Did you want to do a high school and choose this particular one?
Well, I was going to actually do the movie in Boston, but the school that had given me permission in Boston decided that they didn't want me to make the movie there because it was just high school was shot really just 4 or 5 months after the Tiruchirappalli's trial. And so that the principal of the high school in Greater Boston, where I had permission, said reluctantly no. And so I made arrangements to do the movie in Philadelphia.
What interested you in that particular high school in Northeast? Did it epitomize anything in particular to you?
Well, again, I mean, at the time, I don't know how these rankings are determined, but at the time, Northeast was thought to be one of the two best high schools in Philadelphia. I mean, Northeast and Central were thought to be the two best high schools in Philadelphia, and I decided not to do it. I visited a number of high schools in Philadelphia. The superintendent of schools said I could really have my choice as long as I had the permission of the principal of the particular high school, and I visited a number of them, got permission from a number of them, decided not to do Central because it was an all-boys school. I thought it would be more interesting and more representative to do a co-ed high school, and so I picked Northeast. And I had no idea really what I was going to find at Northeast High. It had been 20 years since I'd graduated high school at that time. And everybody was extremely cooperative and pleasant and nice. And they let me hang around the high school for a month. And then it took me 4 or 5 months to edit the material. And when the film, the first screening of the film, really, one of the first screenings of the film was at the Board of Education in Philadelphia. And the superintendent and his staff was there, and the principal of Northeast at the time was there, and they all liked the film. I mean, it's not conjecture. I was there. And they said, oh, that's a fair film. That's, you know, this is what the way it is at Northeast High. Then some of the film appeared at some festivals, I think, or some national critics began to write about the film and praised the film and were very critical of the quality or what they, the national critics, decided was the quality of education there. At that point, some of the people, nobody to my knowledge at the Board of Education, but some of the people at the high school, particularly the principal at that time, then turned against the film. But it was interesting because she and others had seen the film in my presence and really liked it initially.
What were your impressions of Northeast High?
My impressions are what the film is about.
Which is? I mean...
Well, I know it may sound evasive, but I think it's not only true of my high school film, but it's true of any of the films that I made, that I think if I could accurately summarize the film in 25 words or less, I shouldn't have made the film.
Well, the impression that a lot of people have walked away with is that it's a school that, at least in the year that you shot it, used authority to evoke a certain conformity among the students. And there's a scene that I remember very well where I can't remember if it's a Simon and Garfunkel or a Bob Dylan song.
Simon and Garfunkel.
That's being presented. It's read by the teacher in the English class as an example of, you know, rock music as poetry, which is very much in vogue
right.
at the time and perhaps still is in English classes. And it was a really pretty bad reading, I think. It would be fair to say, and it kind of undermined in many ways the intentions of the music. You could say. I was wondering how you felt about scenes like that, how you felt they were presenting the teacher.
Well, I mean, I see myself as a filmmaker, and not a... I mean, I'm being deliberately careful about this because I do think that my view of the experience is what the film is about. And I don't want to be put in a position of having to characterize my own film.
I understand what you mean. The way I sometimes feel as a viewer of your movies is that, as a viewer, it's easy for me to pass judgment on the people that I'm watching, and I don't know that I feel like I really want to be on that particular jury.
Well,
because more even than the institution emerging, you see this whole cast of characters who you get to know, and you're deciding who's fat and who's thin and who's smart and who's stupid and who's respectful of their clients or their students and who's not. Do you know what I mean? And who's,
well, but it's
who's
also
funny and who's,
yeah,
not.
Yeah, but sure, that's certainly one reaction. But then sort of the next step beyond that is, I mean, you have to, you don't have to, but one may then figure out why are you responding that way? So that it's not, the movie becomes not only a reflection of the school, but it becomes, in the sense your interpretation of the movie, then becomes an expression of what your values are in relation to that experience that you're watching on the screen. So it becomes more, if you begin to think about it, it becomes more complicated because then you just say to yourself, why do I think that teacher is good or bad? Or this is an example of a good classroom? Or why am I responding to that person? I mean, so what if the teacher is fat or thin or wearing thick glasses? I mean, is the fact that somebody wears thick glasses make them ugly? I mean, am I responding to some sort of a Vogue magazine standard of beauty? I mean, that you may decide that's the standard of beauty you're responding to, or you may decide, well, that's a really phony standard. So that the movie really, the real movie exists somehow in the relationship of the viewer to the material.
But the viewer is asked to evaluate the material in a way out of context. And what I mean by that is that we don't know anything about the people that we're watching except for what we're seeing on the screen, which mm-hmm. has been carefully selected for us.
That's right.
Already. And if someone is not giving a great performance on the job that day, we don't know what experiences they had the night before. We don't know if they're in a lousy institution because they have three kids and they're desperate to support them and they just couldn't find another job, or whether this is an institution whose ethics they stand fully behind. We just don't know. Do you think that we should know things like that when watching the movie?
Well, I mean, it's only a movie.
Mm-hmm.
A movie like High School or any of the movies I've done, it can't be definitive. And as far as I'm concerned, it makes no pretense at being definitive. Even a book that pretends to be definitive may not be. But certainly in a 1,400-page book, you have the opportunity to cover a lot more than you do in an hour-and-a-half movie, in part because it's a different form, and in part because you have the opportunity to deal with abstractions.
Let's get back to the movie of High School, which was shot at Northeast High in Philadelphia. It's, I believe, never been shown in the city here.
That's right.
What's the reason for that?
Well, the reason for that is that there were some threats of lawsuits at the time, and it was within a year or so after the Follies case. And I simply couldn't afford, although I had no doubt that I would prevail in a lawsuit, I simply couldn't afford another lawsuit. Because the big risk in this sort of thing is not that you're going to lose and there'd be some substantial judgment against you. The expense really isn't defending yourself. And the expense of defending myself in the Follies was just, you know, it took me 7 or 8 years to pay that off. So I just made a practical decision. If someone had come forward and sort of underwritten my legal fees, I would have been happy to take the risk of any judgment.
Did you feel secure that you wouldn't be sued if it were shown in cities outside Philadelphia?
Yeah. Well, in fact, I haven't been.
Right. So you think that's interesting that it would only be controversial
because
if it was shown here?
Well, yes, because, I mean, I suppose the potential, I mean, well, I mean, I mean that's in fact the case. I mean, that's what happened.
Do you think in several years it would be shown here after the cast of characters had changed at the high school?
Well, I don't know. I might be willing to show it here now. I mean, I'd have to sort of assess what the situation is.
Another controversial movie that you did was Primate, which is about the Yerkes Primate Research Institute. And that was shown on public television.
Right.
What were some of the controversies surrounding that film?
Well, I mean, the situation was similar. I mean, the Yerkes film is about research on primates, particularly research directed to determining what portion of the brain controls aggressive and sexual behavior. What portions of the brain control sexual and aggressive behavior. So that a lot of the experiments that were being performed at Yerkes at that time had to do with putting electrodes, removing the skull cap, and putting electrodes in various portions of the brain and running current through to see what the consequences of running current through that portion would be on the primates' behavior. And the primates were, you know, gorillas, orangutans, rhesus monkeys, and squirrel monkeys, and other forms. I mean, those were the principal animals that were being experimented on. And at least in the 4 or 5 weeks that I was there, there was never any discussion of what the reasons for this experimenting, what was involved in this experiment, what was hoping to be gained, except that one person told me about an article that they had written. It was the then director of the center. I mean, this man is no longer the director of the center, but he was saying that he hoped that if this research was successful, electrodes would be able to be planted in the brains of juvenile delinquents, and every time they sort of had a flush of antisocial behavior coming on, they could press a button and it would be discharged. But it seemed to me that the whole emphasis at the time, at least, was on the unconscious goal of it, certainly, was the control of behavior for political purposes. From my point of view, although some people see the film, feel the film is a tract against animal research, from my point of view, it isn't at all. I mean, the animal research is shown in the film, and some people react very violently to using these primates for these purposes. But, I mean, it seems to me, I mean, just on a common sense basis, that if you have something genuine or you feel it's genuine to experiment with, say, like polio vaccine, much better to experiment on an orangutan than a human to find out whether it works. So that, I mean, the film, from my point of view, is not a film that is made to support an anti-vivisection point of view. The film is made in part to deal with some of the political implications of this kind of what I thought at the time was rather unthinking scientific research.
You've recently made several movies that are set in the world of fashion. There's a movie called The Store that's about the Neiman Marcus department store. There's a movie Model that's about a modeling agency and the models who come right. in and out of there. And there's a movie that's about one specific model as well. And I'm wondering about that transition that you made from doing institutions like hospitals and a research institute and a prison for the criminally insane, to going into the fashion world. Did something change in your life that led to that?
No, I mean, it's curious. Some, you know, I've heard that sort of comment before, and I think it partially arises from perhaps a misunderstanding as to what I think I'm doing. Because I think what I'm doing is making a series of thematically connected films, having a look at various aspects of American life through institutions that are important to the functioning of society over a period of time. I've now been doing it for 20 years. I hope I'll, you know, have a go at it for another 20 years. And the result will be, I hope, a body of work that deals with various aspects of American life over this period of time. Now, there are some people who feel that the only proper subject for documentary film is poor people and how they're exploited and how... I mean, I don't happen to feel that way. I think it's a subject. But I'm trying to make, I mean, in a sense, I'm making one long movie, which is now about 40 hours long, about many different aspects of American life. Now, rich people, for example, it's very hard to make a movie in this style about rich people. Because they don't gather in prisons for the criminally insane the way poor people do, who are the principal customers in a prison like Bridgewater. So you pick a department store that is very well known and has very nice quality goods, but I'm interested in the functioning of the department store as an institution, how they buy and sell, how they make decisions about advertising, et cetera. But it's also a way of having a somewhat oblique look at who the customers are, what their values are, what's their attitude toward material goods, what is the quality, how they spend their money, how they spend their time. I mean, one of the interesting things for me about making the movie about Neiman Marcus was the degree to which the same middle-aged women showed up in the store day after day, always buying something. But I realized that it was a form of a club for a lot of them, that they were lonely, and that the sales ladies in some cases were their friends, and it gave them something to do. Well, I mean, that was both interesting, sad, revealing in a way, so that, and some people say, well, how can you make a movie about rich people? But the fact of the matter is, if you're going to have a glimmer of understanding, I mean, and I'm not suggesting that one has an understanding, but if you're going to make an effort to try and understand what's going on in the society, you got to know about a welfare center, a police department, and at the same time, about people who have the money and what their values are and how they spend their money. I mean, in a sense, it seems to me so obvious as not to need an explanation, but apparently it does.
Did you find that the attitude toward you was different at the public institutions where you filmed and at this very expensive department store?
Not at all. I anticipated that it might be, mm-hmm. and was somewhat surprised to discover that it was absolutely no different. I thought I would get more opposition to the filming from people who were more sophisticated about television, et cetera, et cetera. And the fact of the matter is, in that regard, there was no difference between shooting at Neiman Marcus and shooting at a welfare center.
You became a filmmaker when you were in your 30s. Your first career was as a lawyer. It's always a hard decision, I think, for anybody who's already started one career to change into another, especially into one as financially risky as documentary filmmaking. Why did you want to enter into that?
Well, I didn't like being a lawyer. I taught law, and I just simply didn't like it. I was bored. And I guess I reached the witching age of 30 and figured I better do something I liked. And I had been fiddling around making 8mm movies for a long time, and I was interested.
What did you like about documentary movies? You didn't want to go to Hollywood and shoot Hollywood feature films?
No. Well, I'm interested in feature film, but not the kind that gets turned out by the studios. But it just seemed to me there was a whole great, interesting world out there that hadn't been explored in film terms. I mean, and with all the documentary movies that have been made by everybody that makes documentary movies, America is still a relatively unexplored country from the point of view of documentary film. And one of the things that's exciting about it is the fact, if you're lucky and hang around long enough, you're going to stumble across situations that are funnier, more dramatic, more tragic, sadder than almost anything except really great works of literature. And it's not you that have invented them. You've just been lucky enough to be a witness to them and be able to record them on film and include them in a film. But it's an opportunity. I mean, in one sense, it's novelistic. In another sense, it's a form of natural history.
There were many, when you were starting in the mid-60s or so, documentary filmmaking had, I think, just turned a corner. There was cinema verite. There were a lot of documentary filmmakers who were inventing a whole philosophy and style in approaching their subjects. What were some of the theories of that period that excited you, and what were some of the ones that you rejected and thought were really baloney?
I think the whole notion of cinema verite is a baloney notion. I mean, it's just to use it's a French term like that. I mean, the notion that documentary film represents truth rather than one person's view of a matter. I mean, which gets tied in with the whole idea that there's such a thing as objectivity. This, again, strikes me as obvious nonsense, but a lot of people cling to that. And there's also a certain amount of pretension among some documentary filmmakers who I think see the real subject of their films as themselves. There's a lot of autobiographical film, mirror, mirror on the wall sort of thing. Or frequently the documentary filmmaker will be a character in the film, or there'll be lots of shots of the documentary filmmaker in a mirror just to remind the audience that this isn't really true, but it's a movie. And the way to demonstrate that is, if the audience didn't know they were watching a movie, but the way that gets demonstrated is by having a picture of the filmmaker in his filmmaker clothes reflected in a mirror. So I guess I'm part responding to that. And it seemed to me what was interesting was to explore not to pick one's navel, but to see what was out there. And that's quite interesting, to say the least.
None of the movies of yours that I've seen have any narration in it or any interview with it. In a lot of documentary films, the filmmaker will be off camera, but will be asking questions to the person who is the subject of the movie or the subject of that scene, and the person will then be like discussing what they're doing or discussing their life or whatever in response to those off-camera questions. Why have you decided to like not either have narration or interview in your movies?
Well, I guess, you know, it comes down to something as simple as I don't like to be told what to think. And I think when this kind of documentary technique works, where you're photographing and recording unstaged events, it works because, or at least in part, because you're placing the audience in the middle of these events and asking them to think through their own relationship to what they're seeing and hearing, so that the editing of the film, and by the editing I mean what the structure of the final film, represents my point of view toward the material. And that's the substitute for narration. The order in which I present the sequences and the pacing of the sequences is the way I express my attitude. Now, that is related to both traditional storytelling fiction film terms, and it's also related to the way a story gets told in a novel. Because you don't, I mean, of a novel you really like, you don't demand that the novelist summarize his attitude toward the characters in an introductory chapter. I mean, Trollope is a great writer, but we sort of laugh now at his asides where he tells us, I mean, he steps out of the role of the omniscient narrator of the novel and sort of intrudes his own presence. Well, what I try to do is express my point of view indirectly through structure, But leave enough room in the material so that the audience can respond on the basis of their own values. But yet, if they want to think about what my attitude is, they can figure it out by saying, by thinking about what sequences I've included and the order in which I've included them.
What were your impressions of television documentaries at the time you started making movies? And I'd be interested in hearing what you think of the current state of TV documentaries. And we could throw in programs like 60 Minutes in there, too, which use a documentary style for the features that they do.
Well, I mean, I don't really watch. And I've never watched very much of them, mainly because I don't really watch television very much, and also because I'm frequently bored by what I see. But, I mean, it's mainly that I don't have time. I don't like the sort of slick investigatory journalism. Now, which is not to say that I'm opposed, obviously, because I'm not opposed to exposing wrongdoing and injustice, but it just doesn't appeal to me as a filmmaking technique. In part because I don't think there's nothing particularly, excuse the word, filmic about it. It could be just as well done in print. And what I'm interested in is exploring in my own terms, whether successfully or not, trying to figure out what is unique about this particular technique and how that can be, you can push that to whatever limits you think exist in terms of presenting these stories in pictures and sound.
Your latest film, Racetrack, is scheduled for broadcast on public television June 4th.
Right.
Can you give us a preview of it?
Well, it's about the Belmont Racetrack, and I hung around mainly the backstretch and to some extent the grandstand and the paddock, and it's a view of the various activities that are involved in breeding, training, and preparing horses for races, and the kinds of people that work in the backstretch and the people in the grandstand that come to the track. And it is a racetrack like Belmont attracts since representatives of all classes, because you've got poor people working in the stables because it's a job, and you've got the trainers and you've got the various other people working there, and then you've got the owners, some of whom are just ordinary people that own one horse, and others all the way up to some of the richest people in the country and the world that own stables of horses but come down and mingle with the people taking care of them. So that it's a rather any racetrack like Belmont, and there aren't that many, but any big racetrack like, say, Belmont or Santa Anita, or the track where they have the Kentucky Derby, or Pimlico, you get a very wide cross section of American society present.
In some of your movies, you see a professional doing an action, and you don't really understand what the purpose of it is. And in Racetrack, which I've seen this, for instance, a scene where two horses are breeding, and or mating, and the male horse has his penis washed down before and after a copulation, and I don't think there's really any explanation within the movie of why that happens, and it's.
Well, why do you think it happens?
I haven't the slightest idea, but it was an example.
Something to do with cleanliness in relation to. Obviously, it has something to do with cleanliness, doesn't it? I mean, otherwise, why would they wash it down?
I don't know, but it was I didn't know, and I was watching it, thinking, you know, I mean, it does look pretty odd to see some human washing down this enormous phallus of a horse, and behavior like that can look just very, you know, curious. You can ascribe all kinds of false motives to it if you don't really understand why it's being done. So I guess what I'm asking is, how important do you think it is for the audience who's, like, interpreting the behavior of the people in movies to have some kind of explanation in it of what the action is
about? Well, I think it's
about.
My obligation to provide enough information in the sequence so that the viewer can make a reasonable judgment as to why what's going on happens. In that particular sequence, it just... You know, I may be wrong, and it may be a totally other explanation because I've never really inquired. But it just seemed to me it had to do with, in the first instance, being wanting to be sure there was no sort of interference with the delivery of the sperm, because, I mean, I don't know what the breeding fee was in that particular case, but in some cases it runs to $250,000, $300,000 for each mating, so that it's a big business. And I suppose there are the same disease considerations that exist. I mean, not the same diseases, but the same considerations about disease that exist in human breeding.
I'm trying to think about your position of not discussing what your intentions are with movies or what you finally think of the subject of your films. And I guess part of me is a little uncomfortable with that, because I always feel like your opinion is there and it's up to us to crack the code.
Well, I don't think it's so difficult. Uh-huh. I don't think it's so. I mean, I don't mean to make it a mystery.
Then why wouldn't you want to just say it?
Well, because I think it trivializes the subject.
Uh-huh.
And because I think if I've made the film correctly, the final film is an expression of a complex attitude toward a complex subject. And to the extent that I say, well, welfare centers run poorly, or the administrators are poorly trained, or the clients are all psychological or biological basket cases, well, that's demeaning. It's demeaning to both to the administrators and demeaning to the clients, because the problems of each of them are unique, complicated, and manifold, so to speak. And if the movie just even begins to suggest that, it will have accomplished one of its purposes. I think another part of it is that I don't want to set my – there's a certain temptation, which I try to resist, to set myself – I mean, I think it's one that any documentary filmmaker has, or any journalist has, or any radio person interviewing on a radio program has too. And that is the setting yourself up as an instant expert on a subject about which you may not know all that much, but where sometimes the occasion may demand that you assert yourself with an authority that your information or your background on the subject doesn't warrant. So that I'm very hesitant about, say, generalizing about police or the health service delivery systems or welfare or whatever, because to the extent that I understand it, what my understanding is in the film. To the extent that I don't understand it or the film has failed, will be readily apparent to someone who has a greater understanding about it than I do.
Okay. I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, I enjoyed it. Thank you.